This is a disaster brewing on right on their border.
It is the Jade Trade near the China-Myanmar border. It's Wednesday, June 30th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, one Asian country has the largest COVID fatality rate among children in the world. Admission to Harvard brings some Asian students to the U.S. Supreme Court. Pockets of activism in Hong Kong. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Myanmar's coup has handed total control of that country's lucrative jade industry to the military junta, giving them new financial clout to cement their hold on power and threatening fresh instability along its border with China, according to a new report. The jade mines, located in remote Kachin State, are the richest in the world. But instead of an asset swelling the national coffers, they've long been a source of corruption, power, and conflict centered on the military but also involving other armed groups. The civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi tried to clean up the industry. According to the report by the rights group Global Witness, the coup has swept all that way. Now it says the military, known as the Tatmadaw, has total control over who can mine and who can't. It can now dole out licenses as rewards and lures, so shoring up its domestic position at a critical time. One of the report's authors, Kiel Dietz, spoke with the Associated Press.
The Tatmadaw is likely to give away rights to these natural resources, rights to mine, licenses to mine, to other political allies outside of the Tatmadaw. And they can do this because, as I said, they're back in control of this licensing and regulatory apparatus. So they can give out licenses to buy loyalty, and they can give out licenses and mining rights to splinter ethnic armed groups to try to break apart their enemies.
There's been an ongoing war between the Tatmadaw and the Kachin Independence Army in parts of the territory, but one area has been off limits. Its jade's so valuable that both sides have actually cooperated to share its wealth, according to Global Witness. Now fighting has broken out even in the mining areas, threatening what Dietz calls a disaster along the border with China, potentially disrupting economic activity, promoting criminality, and creating streams of refugees from a country struggling to control the coronavirus.
I think it is a very grim picture. And this instability and corruption, I mean, it's not going to be, and I think our report shows this, it won't confine itself. It's not going to remain confined within Pekant and these jade mining areas. Instability breeds instability. And I think that's really important, especially for the Chinese government to understand. This is a disaster brewing right on their border. And I think the Chinese government should be more concerned than they are with what's happening.
Global Witness is calling for the international community to immediately ban the import of all jade and gemstones mined in Myanmar as part of a strategy to cut financial flows to the military junta. Also in Myanmar, ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi asked the people of Myanmar to stay united in the face of military rule, according to her lawyers, as she reappeared in a junta court. The Nobel laureate has been under house arrest since a February coup that sparked huge pro-democracy protests the junta has tried to crush with deadly force. Suu Kyi has been hit with a long list of charges. She could face more than a decade in prison if convicted on all counts. For more information on our top stories, head on over to voanews.com or any of our many digital platforms. We continue on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Indonesia is struggling with another peak of COVID-19. Infections topped 2 million in June, with the Delta variant driving the current surge. And as the country's pediatricians point out, 1 out of 8 of the confirmed cases are found in children, and the fatality rate among children is the highest in the world. VOA's Randy Wickesana has more.
I'm still being quarantined today. About to have my swab test to check if I'm COVID negative.
Vanya Silalahi spent 2 weeks quarantined in Jakarta's COVID-19 hospital with her mother and 5-year-old brother Titus.
My second child, Titus, first got fever. He was shivering at night. The next day, I caught the same symptom, then also my daughter. Our throats started to feel sore. A week after the fever, I discovered I could not smell things.
Silalahi eventually got herself and her children tested. The results came back positive for the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus first detected in India. She decided to quarantine with her two kids in a government facility.
I honestly felt embarrassed to be among these COVID patients. I asked myself, how did I end up here? I had been very strict when it comes to COVID health protocol. This hurts me.
The mother says she tried to keep her kids' spirits up during quarantine and got permission to bring along her children's toys.
Probably I had the most stuff on the COVID bus. I brought a scooter, roller skates, mini cars, every toy for them to play with.
Doctors in Indonesia are reporting an alarming increase in the number of COVID-19 cases affecting children. Indonesia Pediatric Society data says children make up 12.5% of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the country.
This means one out of eight confirmed cases in Indonesia is found in children. Our data shows fatality rate among children with COVID is 3 to 5%. This is the biggest in the world.
Experts say the new Delta variant, along with loose health protocols in Indonesia, have contributed to the spike of COVID-19 cases in Indonesia. Official data show an average of 15,000 daily cases as of June 25th. Pediatricians highly recommend parents to keep their children at home.
All activities involving children 0 to 18 years old are better to be done online.
Renata counts herself lucky as she and her children are now allowed back home and recovering. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Randy Wicaksana for Eva Mazrieva, VOA News.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The U.S. Supreme Court recently asked the Biden administration for its input on a Harvard University admissions lawsuit. For VOA, Connor Smith has more.
The U.S. Supreme Court is facing a case about Harvard University's admission policy that considers race in its selections. The High Court has asked the U.S. Justice Department for input. University of Kentucky professor Gregory Vincent says it's important for the court to seek the administration's views.
I think getting some sense of what the administration is thinking, particularly administration that has a focus on education, I think is interesting. And it's good that they're getting that that viewpoint, especially when you're reviewing a recent precedent.
5 years ago, Vincent was a spokesperson at the University of Texas, Austin, when the school was sued over its affirmative action policies.
What we were able to persuasively argue is that diversity is a compelling interest in higher education, that all students benefit from a robust and diverse learning environment, that it was a national security imperative, and it advanced good business.
The attorney who represented a student against the University of Texas after she was denied admission said affirmative action is bias.
We have said in our briefs, and certainly we've said all along, that race is an odious classification. To do it for reasons that are not compelling and are not established by the evidence and were not the basis of decision is inappropriate.
The U.S. Supreme Court held then in 2016 that using race in admissions decisions is lawful. But now, those who support affirmative action are concerned that the High Court's 6-3 conservative majority could end it. Julie Park is an associate professor of education and advised Harvard on its defense. She says if the lawsuit against Harvard is victorious, it could have a devastating impact on minority students.
It would be disastrous for African-American, Latinx, indigenous communities within higher education, both at Harvard specifically, but then also writ large. Across the country, both in public institutions and private institutions.
If you take race out of the equation, it disproportionately impacts African-American students, Latino students, students from low socioeconomic backgrounds. The traditional measures of so-called merit, like grades and test scores, disproportionately favor students who come from affluent backgrounds who go to high-resource schools.
The lawsuit is led by Edward Bloom, a legal strategist from Texas. Bloom enlisted a group of unnamed Asian American students in the suit. They say that affirmative action suppresses Asian American enrollment in favor of other minorities. But a 2020 survey showed that 70% of Asian Americans support affirmative action.
I've seen Asian Americans who are just confused. We're a diverse community in every way. And so I think you have a variety of reactions.
Vincent says there is a lack of evidence that Asian Americans are excluded in the admissions process. The justices have postponed the case, but didn't reject it.
But it would just send a message, which I think a troubling message, that this issue is still unresolved.
Connor Smith, VOA News, Washington.
Now in VOA Asia, it's been a year since Beijing implemented a sweeping national security law in Hong Kong, aiming to crack down on months of pro-democracy protest. Pockets of activism still exist in the city today, with people regrouping behind an invisible front line that is harder to disrupt with tear gas and rubber bullets. Reuters' Eve Johnson has more.
In a bustling shopping district in Hong Kong, Herbert Chow is walking a fine line, selling memories of the pro-democracy demonstrations that swept the city in 2019. Chow runs a chain of children's clothing stores called Chicky Duck, but this particular shop, with its protest-themed T-shirts, stickers, and pins, could cross the line into crime under the city's national security law. It was handed down by Beijing a year ago and could mean up to life in prison for what mainland China deems subversion, secessionism, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. Chow's shop has already been raided by police, but he says he isn't budging.
I obey the law. I haven't violated the law. The red line of the national security law is always moving. If selling these products is considered inciting the public, if they dare to sink so low, I will fight to the end.
Chow says he still hopes for a democratic future, and he isn't alone. Independent journalist Jade Chung focuses her reporting on the city's most vulnerable. She says that over the past year, self-censorship has crept in, making interviewees and reporters more careful about what they say. But she also says she has no plans to stop.
I still hope to stay and make the city my ideal place. At least I can uphold values. I don't want the new practices to replace them.
Critics say the national security law is being used to chip away at freedoms and stifle dissent. Authorities have made certain songs and slogans illegal. The public broadcaster has removed protest-related archives, and democracy books have been pulled from the shelves of public libraries. Like the shop owner and the journalist, filmmaker Kiwi Chow has his eye to the future, working on a documentary of the protests, he says, to preserve the memory.
If I really get arrested, I will find comfort in the fact that I'm being punished for carrying out justice. And so I am at peace. I have already passed the challenge of fear.
Hong Kong this week also marks the 24th anniversary of the handover from British to Chinese rule. Activist groups have applied for permission to hold a rally, but police have refused.
Eve Johnson reporting. A former senior journalist at Hong Kong's now-closed pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily was released from custody Tuesday, 2 days after he was arrested at the airport, according to local media. 57-year-old Feng Wai Kong became the latest person from the media outlet to be targeted after a raid on the newspaper by 500 officers nearly 2 weeks ago and the arrest of five executives, two of whom have been charged under a sweeping new national security law. Live footage showed Feng leaving a Hong Kong police station, but he declined to comment to reporters. In an email response for comment on Feng's release, police said only that a male suspect had been released from custody. Investigations were ongoing, and the person needed to report back to police in late July. It was not immediately clear what the investigation into Feng was focused on. Feng is the seventh employee at the media group to be arrested in recent weeks, deepening concerns over press freedoms in the former British colony that returned to Chinese rule in 1997. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that includes Jim Stevenson, Amy Hybels, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day and please stay safe.